The Jericho Network on Westwood One. Okay, the new Iron Maiden double album, The Book of Souls, is out now. And I've got Bruce Dickinson, the legendary Bruce Dickinson, here to tell us all about it. Iron Maiden put out a double album in today's digital music era. How insane is that? Nobody does that anymore. And you should see the packaging for this, the album cover we've seen, but you should see the inner workings, the liner notes, the artwork inside. It's totally great. The album is ridiculously good. You got to go check it out. We're going to talk all about that. Plus Bruce, as of course he is going to school all of us on World War I air pilots, as he is a pilot. He's going to tell us what it's like to fly one of those old planes as well. Plenty of great Maiden stories about when he cut his hair, stories about Wise Cousin Chad's band Cletus and the t-shirt that he gave Bruce back in 1988. Bruce remembered it. The songwriting process, Bruce's relationship with Steve Harris. So many great stories. And plus, we're going to talk about Bruce's scare of tongue cancer and larynx cancer. The immortal Bruce Dickinson, the air raid siren himself. So many great stories coming up.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho,
the pot of thunder and rock and roll, the spell you're under has been broken by Chris Jericho.
The remedy for boredom has arrived, the people's podcast is here, let's go for a ride, because it's Friday.
Signs within your mind will make this change complete. And now you'll find that
Ride. I always said that that is the best Iron Maiden song that Iron Maiden ever wrote, especially with the song title, Parascaveda Catriophobia, which is the fear of the day Friday the 13th. It's not Friday the 13th today, but it is Iron Maiden Day. Book of Souls has just come out, and I worked my collective, literal, figurative butt off to get Bruce Dickinson live here on Talk is Jericho. I want to bring you the biggest guests that I can possibly get. And let me tell you the long story, the long road. Here's what I have to do to get these people on the show for you. I know Rod Smallwood, Iron Maiden's manager. For whatever reason, I met him years ago, and I've always kind of got along with him well, and he is a Fozzy fan. He comes and sees us whenever we play in Brighton, which is where he lives, the Brighton Concord 2. Shout out to the Brighton Concord. Always have great gigs there. And he came and saw us there a few times. The one time I was convinced he was coming to scout us to open for Maiden, and he came and watched the show, and when we were done, I said, "What'd you think?" He said, "That was good, but don't wear shirts with big faces on them." I was wearing a shirt with the Rev from Avenged Sevenfold, a big face of his. Rich was wearing like a big shirt of like a fox or something like that. He's like, "All you guys wear sleeveless shirts with big faces on them. Please don't do that." And I was like, "All right, there you go. Fashion advice from Rod Smallwood." But anyways, the last time we were there, we were talking about you know, the stuff that I do, and I was telling about the podcast, and I wanted to get Rod Smallwood on. Rod said it wasn't the right time because Bruce had just been diagnosed with tongue cancer, and they didn't really know exactly what was going to happen with Bruce and with all of his issues that were going down with him. So I said, "Well, when you're ready to promote the new record, let me know, and I want a piece of it." I said, "I'd like to do it in person, and I want Bruce or Steve," being Steve Harris, the bass player for Iron Maiden. And he said, "Well, I can't guarantee that." He said, "I'm not sure what we're going to do, but I'll try and get you one of the lads." I said, "Well, I want Bruce or Steve." I said, "My show is blowing up over here, super popular. We've now done over 100 million downloads. Wow. Thanks to all of you guys for listening to the show and for making that come true." So I said, "Well, keep me in the mix." I sent them all the details, got connected with Iron Maiden's publicist. And lo and behold, a couple months later, when Bruce has announced that he's okay and Book of Souls is coming out, and I just contacted them again, "Keep me in mind when you guys do some press." So about a month ago, I get a call from Iron Maiden's press agent, Todd Nakamine. Shout out to Todd. Thanks for all the help. And also thanks to Dave Shack. And thanks to Rod Smallwood for kind of helping make all this happen. But Todd said, "Well, you can get Bruce for a phoner. He'll be in New York City on, you know, August 31st and September 1st. And I said, "Well, if he can do a phoner, then why can't we just do it in person? I mean, if he has to get in the phone, unless he does interviews while he's in bed, and I can even deal with that. I don't care." And they were like, "Well, let's see if we can work it out." And I said, "I'll come to New York. I'll fly to New York specifically for Bruce, because person face-to-face, in-person interviews are always better than doing them over the phone. Now, I'll do them over the phone if I have to, and we can always have good shows that way. But face-to-face is always better. Plus, it's Bruce Dickinson. I mean, come on, Bruce Dickinson, one of my all-time vocal heroes, one of my favorite vocalists from one of my favorite bands. I mean, I've got Iron Maiden tattooed on my arm, for gosh sakes." So they called me back and said it'll work out, and said, "How much time do you need?" I said, "Well, I knew if I shot for the stars," I said, "well, if I ask for 60, maybe I'll get 45, because they were offering 30. I'm like, "Well, I usually do 60. That's usually my limit." And they came back and said, "Fine, you got an hour with Bruce Dickinson in New York City on Tuesday, September 1st. Oh, my gosh. So I did the show in Tallahassee for the WWE, ending the Y2J summer tour. Then flew to New York City the next day. I did a podcast that evening, which I'll announce later on. And then the next morning, Tuesday morning, at the undisclosed hotel in New York City, Bruce Dickinson and I were set to have our chat. So I got a room at the hotel. Went at 10:30 to the room where I was supposed to be to talk to Bruce. And then I had to wait. And while I was waiting, because Bruce was finishing up another interview in another room, Todd and Dave Shackey showed me the new Maiden record. The packaging on it is insane. I finally got a chance to read all the lyrics, because I had gotten the album the week beforehand and I had to sign a waiver to get it. That's how old school Iron Maiden is. Back in the day, you wouldn't be sent advanced copies of the record. You would go into a room and you would hear the album once, and then write your reviews based on hearing it once. And then when people started to leak albums, and they used to, you know, all the MP3s and all that sort of stuff. They stopped doing that completely. So you still send advanced copies out, but for a band like Maiden, they're only sending streams, and you have to sign a waiver to get one. And that waiver says, if you play this for anybody else, if this leaks in any way, shape, or form, every one of the streams that we're sending you has a name, has a number on it, has a code on it, and we'll know that it's yours. So, you know, mine is number 2728 or whatever. So if this leaks out anywhere, they just have to punch it in. They'll see 2728 and then they can sue me. So needless to say, I've been listening to the new Maiden record for about 2 weeks now, week and a half, and I haven't let anybody hear it. I've just been crowing about how great it is. My favorite song so far, actually the whole first side is incredible. If eternity should fail. I love Speed of Light. I love The Red and the Black, The Book of Souls, When the River Runs Deep, and then of course the 18-minute epic, The Empire of the Clouds, written by Bruce Dickinson. We'll talk all about that upcoming. So anyways, I got a chance to see the new record, the packaging of it, and Maiden still goes that extra mile to give you, you know, the little bit extra as a buyer, especially in this day and age when everybody just downloads it off of iTunes or whatever it may be. Maiden still gives you a reason to want to buy the physical copy. And I saw the LP and I saw the CD. The CD is just as impressive. There's a book inside and there's all this great artwork and all this cool stuff. Maiden's one of the last bands that when they put out a new record, there's still a buzz about it. You know, it's still an event. I remember taking the bus downtown to Records on Wheels in Winnipeg, Manitoba to get somewhere in time. And I'll never forget walking in and hearing Heaven Can Wait. And I knew it was the new Maiden, but obviously I hadn't heard it yet. And I just sat there and listened to it as I was looking at the front cover of Somewhere in Time and just going over all the clues and all the pictures. And the new record is kind of has that vibe to it as well as far as the packaging of it and stuff. So it was an event in 1986 to have a new Maiden record come out. And it's an event now in 2015 to have a new Maiden record come out. And so getting a chance to interview Bruce Dickinson before the record came out. I mean, you know, all my friends are like, oh my God, I can't believe it. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. You got Bruce Dickinson. I'm like, well, it's really cool. And I'm fanboying out about it now. But at the time, as soon as Bruce comes in, I got a job to do. You know, I got to be a professional. And we've never really met. We've crossed paths a few times. And I'm pretty good friends with Adrian Smith of Iron Maiden, but Bruce never really talked to him much. So he doesn't know me. He doesn't know what kind of a show I have. Probably knows nothing about me. But as soon as we started talking, he was, boom, he's super into it, super excited, super happy. As you'll hear, he was great during the interview. Never learned so much about World War II biplanes in my life, as you'll hear. And then as soon as the interview was done, he basically got up and they were on to the next thing. You know, and they tried to wrap me up after 45 minutes. And I was like, sure, just a couple more questions. Then we ended up going another 10 minutes. So I got my hour. I always get what I want. And he got up and shook my hand. I took a picture with him and he was out the door. So I did get an email later on from the publicist and from Rod saying that Bruce really enjoyed the interview. It was a blast. Bruce Dickinson, one of the greatest rock and roll singers, one of the greatest frontmen of all time, and a super interesting guy. So the fact that I got an hour with Bruce, I take great pride in that, and really thank Iron Maiden and the whole Iron Maiden organization. And I'm telling you right now, the Book of Souls is a tremendous record. It's long. It's 90 minutes long. It takes about 3 or 4 listens to start really getting into it. Some of the songs pop right off the bat, like Speed of Light. But listen to it. Listen to it a lot. It's my favorite Maiden record so far, basically since the reunion happened, and maybe even before that, since Seventh Son of a Seventh Son. So go out and check that out. Bruce Dickinson is coming up very, very soon. I'm excited. Bruce, always good to his fans, and I try and emulate that with my fans, all of you great, great Talk is Jericho, Sexy Beast listeners. As a matter of fact, I got an email the other day sent to the podcast, one email from Tina St. Pierre, and she asked if we could wish her husband, Ken St. Pierre, happy birthday. He's turning 43. He's a big fan of Fozzy, a big fan of Talk is Jericho, and his birthday is actually today, September 4th. So it's not only Book of Souls, Bruce Dickinson Day, but it is also Ken St. Pierre Day. So this show officially is the Ken St. Pierre Presents Talk is Jericho featuring Bruce Dickinson. So there you go, Ken. Thanks for helping me present this show. Happy birthday to you. You got a great wife there. Tina made this happen. And I made it happen to say happy birthday to you. So, happy birthday, and Bruce Dickinson, Book of Souls Day, coming up after this.
All right, in the catacombs of the Iron Maiden hotel here, with I have to bring this up with the air raid siren, Bruce Dickinson.
Okay,
best nickname ever.
Yeah. Who that? Yeah, it wasn't me that thought of it either. It was Rod actually.
Oh, he came up with it.
Yeah, he came up with it. Yeah, he attributed it to some inventive fan, but it was him.
It's like a publicity trick.
Yeah, and the same thing with I think whatever the quote is on the back of the album, Number of the Beast album, you know, dedicated to all like earth rats, hell dogs, and yeah. Whatever, and we all went, what is this shit?
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, it sounds great. I said, what is an earth rat?
I grew up in Canada, right? So when I read that, I thought maybe that's some kind of an English a term for a headbanger.
Yeah, and
an earth rat.
I was like, no, you know. Anyway, yeah. Never mind.
So, earth rats, yeah, and hell dogs.
Earth rats, hell dogs, and whatever else.
Yes,
it was,
but that only lasted for the Number of the Beast record, the air raid siren.
Yeah, we put a stop to that after that.
You didn't like it?
No. The air raid siren thing, that sort of carried on, yeah. You know. But in fact, now I come to think of it, I know exactly where the air raid siren came from. It was a complaint letter that somebody saw us at the Rainbow Theatre, which is where I made my sort of UK debut. We'd mm-hmm. done four or five shows in Italy. And then we came back and we did the Rainbow Theatre. So, of course, there were lots of people there that seen, you know, Paul, the previous singer. And they obviously, I was the new boy on the block, you know. And somebody wrote a letter saying, the new singer sucks, you know. It's like hearing your favourite songs played through a cement mixer by an air raid siren. And he went, oh, I like that, the human air raid siren.
Right.
And so he stole that from the letter of complaint. That's
the human cement mixer doesn't have the same ring to
not
it.
Not something else.
The human air raid siren.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and here we are, though, on the eve of Maiden putting out the new record, Book of Souls. And first of all, the audacity you're showing to put out a double record in this day and age. Don't you know that you're not supposed to do that anymore?
Well, no, I don't know how they're going to stream it. I mean, I don't know. How do you stream an 18-minute song?
Absolutely, right.
You break the network or something. I don't know what you do. I mean,
but it's amazing to, like, we were just actually, as we were waiting for you, looking through some of the packaging of this new record, Book of Souls. And it's incredible. The artwork, the lyrics, you know, the picture of the band, you know, in the Mayan kind of totem pole or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
Still such a, in this day and age when people don't read lyrics and don't even have a lot of physical copies, Maiden's still going the extra mile to put out something extra.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the whole point. Why bother writing lyrics if you don't want people to read them?
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, I mean, I guess we're throwbacks or something, or some strange breed of animal that thinks that actually what we do is worth something.
Yeah, but your millions of fans agree with that.
Yeah, well, that's great. I mean, and it's great there are people out there that actually do think that things are worth listening to and worth keeping. I think more people actually than some people realize think that.
Right.
You know, because I don't think that all human beings are necessarily shallow and defined by what they see on, you know, TV about, you know, Hollywood Wives or whatever it is, you know, that sort of, you know.
But the thing is, you know, listening to it, the streaming copy, which I had to sign a release for, which is
old school and cool.
So the thing about Iron Maiden is, like, you know, growing up as a fan, I actually learned things from Iron Maiden. You could learn, like, what is a rhyme of the Ancient Mariner? Who is Samuel Taylor Coleridge? Whatever. So listening to the new record, I can't read the lyrics because I don't have them.
Oh, really?
Well, because I didn't have them. Now I'm looking
them
today.
Oh, okay. Right.
I was devouring them because I'm like, I don't know what these songs are about, but I need to learn because they have such great titles. And you know they're historical in account or whatever. That's something that Maiden always did. You're doing it on this record as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of having like you know, Empire of the Clouds.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's about some kind of a warship or something, but I don't know because I can't read the lyrics.
Yeah. Well, that's actually got quite a big Canadian connection. If you, you
oh
know.
Really?
Yeah. Well, it's sister ship, the R-100 airship did a transatlantic crossing to Montreal and back, and that was built by a guy called. Designed by a guy called Barnes Wallace, and he designed the bouncing bomb that famous that in the dam busters that did the German dams and things like that. So that in itself is a whole other story, that how they built these two ships one beside the other. One was government funded, and the other one was privately funded, and it was like a competition between the two to see which one would win the contract to send all these airships round the world, this big armada that was supposed to link the empire, you know, link, you know, the England with Australia and Canada, and this big sort of conveyor belt of airships.
The Commonwealth. Going,
yeah, the Commonwealth, yeah, all of that stuff, yeah. The R-100, which is the privately built one, built by Vickers, flew first and flew across the Atlantic and back and went, there you go. And they said, well, you can't win the contract yet because we've got to let the government won, which was bigger. And the reason it was bigger was because everything on it was heavier and took longer. And, you know, the R-101 was the one that took off for India before it was adequately tested, before it was structurally sound.
But what is it, like a plane? Is it just a big giant?
Giant airship. It's a Zeppelin. Think Hindenburg.
Okay, so you're looking more of... Okay.
Think Hindenburg. Gotcha. But it was bigger than the Hindenburg, I think. And it was so big, in fact, that you could put the Titanic inside
That's
it.
That's one of the lyrics.
Yeah, yeah. And you could fit the Titanic inside it from the top of the funnel to the bottom
Which
of the
is incredible.
Keel.
This thing is huge.
Huge. This thing's floating over your head, you know, just chugging over your head about 100 miles an hour, you know.
Right.
And it had, you know, 54, 55 people on board it, I think. 56, was it? I forget. Anyway, there's 48 people survived, died in it when it finally went down. And it was a crash which, although it's not many people remember it now, at the time, it was a combination of, if you can imagine, the Challenger accident, you know, the Titanic and the Concorde crash, and all rolled into one. Mm. It was on that scale. And the bodies, when they came back to England, were given a state funeral, gun carriages, procession. They were laid in state in Parliament for 3 days, which only happens to kings and queens. And these weren't like all important people. These were just all the normal guys that were on the thing. But there was royalty on board. There was two ministers from the government were on board. They're all killed in it.
What year are we talking?
1930.
Okay.
1930. So, you know, it's a few years before the Hindenburg. But, of course, this thing crashed in the middle of the night in a wood in Beauvais in northern France in a terrific storm. When it crashed, nobody saw it. All they saw was the wreckage afterwards, you know, which... I've got the pocket watch of one of the survivors.
Really?
Yeah, and a couple of artifacts from the airship itself that weren't on the airship. They obviously had duplicate sets of crockery and cutlery and all this kind of stuff. And I'm guessing that I've got a tankard, which is embossed around the top, welcome aboard from the airship crew.
Wow.
From 1930. It's a leather tankard with the airship embossed on the outside with the registration of it. It's very cool. I went to an auction of airship memorabilia and came back with the pocket watch was something I really had my eye on. This, I think I am going
to
go after.
Did you have to go to an auction to do it?
Oh yeah.
Was
there
anybody else bidding for it as well?
Oh God, yeah. Oh yeah.
You bastard, stop it already.
No. I was just like, no. I was determined to do that. And there was a lot of stuff there you know, the Graf Zeppelin and the Hindenburg and sets of crockery which were, you know, left at home when it went on its voyages, you know, the alternate sets. So they were all there. You know, you could buy yourself a tea service from the Hindenburg, but those were going for kind of stupid money.
Do you collect a lot of stuff like that?
No, not a lot.
Just that one?
Not a lot. I specifically was interested in getting some things about, you know, English airships. And of course, everybody's all about the Germans. It's all about, you know, there's a piece of a Zeppelin that crashed in the First World War. It's like, yeah, okay, yeah, we know all that. But actually, we have this huge industry that I found that absolutely fascinating, you know. And when I was a kid, I used to made a big plastic model of the R-101.
So this is something you've been interested in your whole life?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Interesting. Because flying is a passion of yours.
Yeah.
And airships and the whole concept of being a pilot and all this sort of thing.
Yeah.
When you were a kid, did you want to be, like, for me, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a wrestler in a rock and roll band.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone was like, oh, you'll never do either one of those things. When you were a kid, did you want to be in a rock and roll band and be a pilot?
No, I wanted to be it depends what age you just, you know, like 5 or 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
musician was the last thing on my mind. I wanted to be either a steam train driver or a fighter pilot
okay.
or an astronaut.
I think astronaut goes for all of us.
Yeah,
right?
You know, yeah.
But a fighter pilot, so there have to be a war for that to happen, though.
No, you can get trained up as a fighter pilot.
Okay.
And I mean, I'm not sure whether fighter pilots really quite like the idea of wars.
Yeah.
You know, it means they get shot at and might die, you know.
So, yeah. But don't you fly some of those, like, biplane old school World War II planes as well?
Yeah, I've got actually, mine are a bit older than the replica that I fly is a replica of a World War I aeroplane. Hmm. So they're even more primitive in the way
they're
handled.
It's like Red Baron type stuff.
It is exactly. The one that I fly is a Fokker DR1 triplane. So it is the three-plane, the triplane type that von Richthofen flew at a point in his career. But it's the one that everybody remembers. But he actually flew many different types of airplanes.
So when you're flying something like that, though, like, I mean, have you ever had any close calls? I mean, it seems like it wouldn't be very stable to be flying a World War One biplane.
No, it's not stable at all. It's a fighter. It's designed to be unstable, which is why it's a brilliant dogfighter, because all you have to do is blow on it and it goes, you want to change direction.
Weaving
yeah.
and turning.
Yeah. So it's fantastically unstable. So you have to fly it constantly. There's no autopilot. There's no electrical system on it. There's nothing. You've got a magnetic compass, and that's it, really.
Is it like driving a car without automatic transmission? Like, are you really having to hold on to the thing?
Oh no, it's very. The controls are relatively light, but they're very. It doesn't handle like a modern aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Modern aircraft, a lot of the weird characteristics have been taken out. They've been designed out, so the thing is, you know, quite controllable and docile. And you know, if it gets disturbed, it comes back to on an even keel. It's fairly stable. This was never designed to be like that, and they were never designed to last very long.
Hmm.
You know, it was never envisaged that these aircraft would last longer than, you know, like 6 months or something, because they were going to get shot down. So
eventually, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know. So hence they were made out of wood, and you know, you could kind of lash them up back together and off you go. The airfoils that they were using for the wings, again, quite primitive in some respects, and that meant that, you know, when you fly, you know, behind another aircraft in one of these things, you know, when you get like disturbed air or something else like that,
mm-hmm.
The thing will stop flying. You can end up, you know, on your side in a heartbeat in mm-hmm. one of these things and sort of wrestling the thing back to upright.
Yeah.
You've got to use everything. You know, you're putting great big boot full of rudder in there and all kinds of stuff to get it back, which with a modern aircraft, it is. They are more docile, you know, and on the ground, it's completely unpredictable.
Even just landing it, you mean, or
these aircraft were never designed to land on the whole concept that we have of a runway didn't exist.
Mm.
So you landed in a field, and whichever way the wind was blowing, you landed straight into wind. So there was no necessity to have a brakes. They didn't have brakes, you know.
Yeah.
You landed on grass. They had a tail skid. And that was it. And then they had a whole posse of guys would come running out to meet you and grab hold of the wings of the airplane so it didn't sort of flip around and do a 180 on you.
Oh, really? And, so it's very light then?
It's not so much that it was light, but it was you have no directional control on it. Mm. Once the tail actually sinks down onto the ground, on particularly on a triplane, because you've got these three, it's like flying behind a big Venetian blind.
Hmm.
So what it does is it blanks the airflow from the propeller over the tail. And at that point, you have no control. I mean, you don't have any brakes. You don't have any wheel at the back to steer it with. So if there's a breath of wind from the side and the thing starts to wibble, because it's so unstable, it'll just swap ends and, you know,
you'll be flying.
You do a 180 on yourself, right. You know. It's if you fly a triplane, you just better get used to sometimes ending up facing the wrong way around, you know, because it is going to happen on you, you know.
Well, you're very knowledgeable about this, and we're talking about the R101. You built these models when you were a kid. What finally inspired you to write a song about it 35 years into your Maiden career? I mean, this is tailor-made for a Maiden song.
I guess the thing was that I had these bits. Okay, let's go back to the song was written on piano.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a piano, and then about 2 or 3 years ago, I won a piano in a raffle. and so I go back and I take this piano back home, take it out of its cardboard box, and the electric piano with a pair of speakers on it. So I started mucking around on it, you know, the first thing you do is it's very easy to come up with, you know, little atmospheric things that suggest a little melody or something. So what I thought these little melody things were going to turn into was, you know, something. I was going to write something about the First World War, and it would start off a very atmospheric, you know, morning, and then something horrific would happen when they took off. And but that didn't happen as a song. Death or Glory happened instead.
Okay.
With Adrian. And so I thought, okay, well, so what do I do with all these little pieces? And I'm sat there, and I've got my kind of, you know, little writing room where I sit and tinkle on the piano and stuff. And behind me in the kind of like bookcase and stuff, I'm looking, and I've got this big model of an airship, and I've got the tankard, and I've got the book about the crash. And I'm thinking, I'll just write it. Why don't you do the R101 story?
Mm-hmm.
And I went, that's a big project. And I went, well, you know, you've got plenty of time. So that's how the idea started. And then it was a question of planning it at that point then, because you say, well, okay, where are we going to start? I said, well, I've got this bit about, you know, the morning sunrise, red before the blue. Let's start at dawn on the day it crashed. Mm. Let's do the last day. And through the last day, we tell the story of the whole thing. So we can just flash back a little bit to some of the problems in telling the story on the last day. And I thought, well, that's okay. Let's get started then. So I started writing some more words. I joined two book titles together as the opening two lines of the song. Hmm. There's a book called Empire of the Clouds, which is not about the airship. It's about the British aviation industry, you know, after the Second World War, okay. and how we basically gave it away, you know, to the rest of the world, you know, and screwed up. But I thought Empire of the Clouds. I was either going to call it that, or the other book was called To Ride the Storm, which is actually an accident investigation into the R101. Mm. And that was the source material of a lot of the facts that I got involved with. So I thought, To Ride the Storm, okay. But Empire of the Clouds, that sounds better to me. Mm-hmm. And it's ironic.
Sounds epic.
It sounds epic. And it's ironic as well, because it's exactly what it was supposed to be. Mm. It was supposed to be an empire in the clouds, of the clouds, you know, the British Empire, and this hugely powerful airship going around, a symbol of national virility and everything. So I just joined the two book titles together, and the opening line was To Ride the Storm to an Empire of the Clouds. I thought, okay, so that's the story you're going to tell. You're going to tell the story of To Ride the Storm to an Empire of the Clouds. Off we go. So wrote the narrative bits, and then realized, okay, well, we're going to have a bit where the airship leaves the mast and takes off. And then we're going to have the exciting bit, and then it's going to go into a storm. And it's going to be chucked around in the storm, and we're going to write the storm bit, and then we're going to have the ending of it.
The crash.
The crash at the end. And then somewhere in the middle of all this, I came up with this little bit, which is actually the intro. The intro to the song actually came up, I was about halfway through writing it. And so the bit at the beginning, the little melody, happened at the beginning. And I thought, that's great, because that links so many pieces together. I can sort of reprise it at the end. And then I suddenly thought, well, you know what? I've got kind of a little overture thing going here at the beginning, because I've got so many little pieces now. I can actually condense them all into a nice little instrumental section at the beginning, in which you sort of state all the bits that are going to happen later on. And it's kind of, it becomes an almost sort of little sort of concerto or whatever it is. I don't know. I
mean, symphonic thing.
Whatever
we're rock
that is.
Guys,
you know, yeah. I don't know exactly. You know. I went, hey, that's really cool. I thought this is getting excited. I'm getting excited about this now. You know.
Let's get back to Bruce Dickinson. When you're writing, you talk about piano. Do you have a guitar as well? And are you writing riffs and melody lines?
No.
You sing them?
No. It's all on. I write the words down, so I know what the melody wants to be in my head. In the case of Empire, then the piano line itself is itself a melody.
Yeah, sure.
So that kind of suggests
the piano line and the vocal line are the same.
They're more or less the same. Mm-hmm. Yeah, more or less the same. And in fact, it's becoming a bit of an issue because I've started writing more stuff on piano, and it's now getting really hard to write the words because you sit there and you go, oh, it's a really nice. Wow, I just love that melody. It's great, isn't it? You know, you think, well, what are you going to sing? Be ashamed to spoil it, you know.
I don't want to get that involved.
Yeah.
So do you take it to the band and say, here's what I've got, and then they kind of put together their pieces in there? Because I'm assuming if it's just a Dickinson song, as Empire is, that you're writing the entire thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, but you're not playing guitar, though?
No, I play piano.
So you just tell them this is how it goes?
Yeah. So all the bits none of the bits on Empire were ever written with a guitar in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was written for fiddles or burrens or horns or strings or cellos or whatever, knowing full well that it was going to be played by guitars.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have the guitar in mind when I wrote it. But I realized clearly, obviously, it was going to get played by guitars. So the little kind of the mad little Irish, that's an Irish jig. That's a fiddle, you know, and a burren, which is an Irish.
What's it called?
A burren. I think it's spelled Bodran, Bodran, but a bit of burren. And it's if you ever go to a folk club and you see him, it's like a big tambourine, but without the bells on it, and they use a beater. So you get these great, there's fantastic rhythms on it. And that's that rhythm, but get Nick to play that. And he understood exactly what I was talking about when I said it's like a kind of thing for a burren. And he went, ah, gotcha, you know. And he was off. So Nick was really key to the whole thing because he had to link percussively all the atmospheres that were involved and hold it all together. So he was fantastic, actually. And he was really excited about it. He sat, because I'd play him the bits. I'd add a new bit sometimes, and then I'd start arranging things, and I'd say, well, we got it, this happens, and this happens. He goes, oh, this is really good, Dredd. He said, carry on, you know. And Steve was the same thing. And so I played Steve the whole lot in sequence, and a great big list, two pages of A4 of arrangement. And said, and then this happens, then that, then this bit, and then there's this bit, and this, and then it goes to there, and then blah, blah, blah. And he went, yeah, don't change a thing. That's it. I went, wow, okay.
That's great, right?
You know. And then off we go. And then of course, I had to play piano on the damn thing, which was, I mean, and I am, you know, I'm, you know, I'm the one-fingered Rachmaninoff, and even that's just a little finger. That's
did
all
you
I've
use
got.
The piano that you won in the raffle?
No. I tell you what, I wished I did, because it, I think it had a MIDI, that would have had a MIDI out. We used a MIDI keyboard to go do it, which was a horrible thing. It was like some dreadful little Bontempi kids organ thing with absolutely no feel whatsoever. But, you know, we could get a take out of it that way because my piano skills strictly limited, you know, L plates on, you know, provisional driver, you know, training wheels.
Right.
And that way, at least if I screwed up a couple of notes, we could go into MIDI and just edit them and put them in the right place, because otherwise we'd have been there till Christmas trying to get me to do a take of the whole song, because the band has to play effectively to the piano for the first 3 or 4 minutes of that tune. It's something we've never done before.
Never. Yeah, it's the first time I can think of a piano being on any Maiden song like that.
Yeah, yeah. That's like the lead instrument,
right?
And so, yeah, and yeah. I mean, I don't suppose we'll ever play it live. In fact, I'm almost 100% certain we won't play it
live.
You'd
be like Elton John with the piano, with the microphone, singing.
God forbid, no, you know.
A little cap on.
Yeah, there'd be a little furry rabbit going across the top of the me with a big mallet trying to hit it, you know. Whack-a-mole, you know.
Yeah, exactly, When you mentioned before that you played this whole thing for Steve, is he kind of like the guy that you need to get the approval from to be like, let's do it?
Yeah, I mean, in general terms, yeah,
mm-hmm.
You know, so we'd go in and play stuff, and I mean, there's going to be somebody who is that, you know, the sort of an ultimate arbiter of life, universe, and everything, and it's Steve, basically. You know,
must be kind of cool when he gives you the thumbs up. You're like, all right,
no, it's all right, no, yeah. It's good. I mean, but the thing is that by the same token, you know. If he comes along with an idea and everybody goes, not sure about that, you know.
You can veto him as well sometimes.
Well, it's not so much a veto thing. It's not as childish as that. Thing, you know, I mean.
This is rock and roll. Come on, we're mature now.
I know. Yeah, well, we are kind of. We're depressingly so sometimes,
yeah,
you know.
Right.
But actually, I kind of prefer it that way.
back when in the 80s when you're in your 20s. And
oh, God, yeah. It's full of piss and vinegar.
It's a different style. Yeah. I was going to ask you, too, as a singer, I'm listening to The Red and the Black, which is a great song off the new record, Book of Souls. And the melody line, it's a Steve song, and the melody line is very busy at parts.
Yeah, no.
Is it hard sometimes to sing the lyrics? Because there's a lot of...
No, absolutely. No, he drives me nuts when he does that. And I know why he does it now. I could never figure out why he wrote words like that. And it's because he follows the meter of the song slavishly, absolutely slavishly. So me as a singer, I'll say, okay, so the song's doing that, so we don't need that syllable, that syllable, that syllable. We can kind of just like wave through it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But no, he's like, no, he's like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I said, well, why can't you go da 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 dum da da dum ba da dum da da da? Because it doesn't go like that.
Yeah, because I wonder sometimes if you're talking about like I even had to write it, the Kuritz Hadarach, he was born of Caladan, he must take the Gom Jabbar.
Yeah, right.
When you're reading lyrics of this, like, how as a singer am I supposed to relate to this to sing it, right?
It's like, are you serious? Yeah. You know, I mean,
I know Geddy Lee has that sometimes with the Neil Peart lyrics, so it's like, what the hell is this?
Yeah, what the hell is this? Yeah, you do. I'm going to get used to it. But he's getting better, actually. I mean, there's some great stuff. I mean, Tears of a Clown, it's got some great words on it.
Absolutely.
You know,
it's almost, does that have anything to do with Robin Williams?
Yeah, it is. It's about Robin Williams. Yeah,
okay.
I mean, I didn't realize that. I sang the song, obviously, and I said, these are kind of cool. What's this one about, Steve? And he went, Robin Williams. I went, ooh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, you can see that Tears of a Clown. I kind of was wondering that right off the bat.
Yeah.
I mean, we were kind of laughing earlier about, you know, in the first wave of Maiden's giant, huge popularity in the 80s, and then now Maiden bigger than ever in 2015. You mentioned the relationships are different because you're older. How is the relationship with Steve and Bruce in 2015 in comparison to 1988 or 85 or whatever?
It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, really good. I mean, well, I just said last night, when I got diagnosed with all this stuff, you know. And we were chatting on the phone. He said, how are you doing? I said, yeah, I'm okay, you know. And he said, I'm going to send you a present. I went, oh, that's nice, you know. And he sent me a trampoline. He said, I know you're like watching a lot of daytime TV at the moment. He said, he'd give you something to like to exercise. I once went out with a side story. It's lovely. It's very sweet. And the kids would come in and go, Dad, why have you got this little trampoline in front of the TV? I said, just Steve just sent me it to make me feel better. just jumping up and down. I watched a football match, you know, and I'm like watching jumping up and down this trampoline, you know, and I thought this is really dangerous. I'm going to fall off this and kill myself in a minute, you know.
Part of the new stage show, Bruce is doing flips on the trampoline, you know, while singing.
Oh, funny, man. Yeah. I once went out for a beer with years ago back in the 80s, and we were in Amsterdam doing a record, and for some reason the boss of the Amsterdam chapter of the Hell's Angels was hanging out, and he was a very nice guy because we're not Hell's Angels, so we didn't want to know about whatever he got up to. But and he had terrible girlfriend problems, so we went out once for sort of a guy thing, you know, and we getting drunk. He's talking about his girlfriend, all these issues and stuff, and then he got around to saying, you know, how great it was, you know, with the chapter, because they used to help all the other Hell's Angels and these stuff. And I said, one of my guys, he said, oh, it was just so cool. He said, because he had terminal cancer and he was dying. And he said, and we all clubbed together and we got him a dishwasher. And I went, okay. And he said, oh, I said, the guy was in tears. He said, I've never had a dishwasher before in my life. And it was just this bizarre moment. Right, what sure. What do you buy somebody who's dying of cancer? Have a dishwasher.
There you go. It's perfect. I mean, you can have clean dishes, way or another.
Yeah, you know. I mean, it's just a bizarre aside. I thought, is this my dishwasher moment? You know, I mean.
Well, when you're talking about trampoline and kind of we're laughing, but when you're preparing for a tour, it's been a few years, and talking about the melody lines that you're singing and the new record, it hasn't changed. It's still the classic Air Raid Sirens.
Yeah, it's full on, yeah. It's all full on, yeah.
And you still sound great. You can hit all those notes, and you pick your spots for the really crazy screams, Number of the Beast, etc. But you sound great. How do you prepare for a tour knowing the task ahead of you, not just singing these melody lines, new ones that you sang when you were 25, and also putting on the show that you put on as a great frontman?
Well, you have to give yourself plenty of lead in time. Mm-hmm. Really, I mean, when you're in you know, 2-3 weeks into a tour, you go into sort of tour mode. Your voice becomes kind of fairly bomb-proof. You know, it's just used to doing it every day, or every other day, or whenever we do it. And you can take a break of, you know, 3-4 weeks, and come right back, and. It'll be right back. It's like, nothing really is, nothing much changes, you know. And you take a break of a few more months, and you think, I'm going to need a couple of weeks to get back into this. Depending on what you've been doing in between. I mean, if you've been singing in an album or stuff like that, then yeah, great. Shouldn't be an issue. But obviously, I've been off from, you know, finishing the album November till November. It's going to be a year and a half since I've done any really sort of big old belting on the voice. And of course, a lot has happened in between, you know, with the health thing and you know, taking lumps out of the space in my throat. So at the moment, while things are still returning to normal, I mean, things are still pretty normal, you know, but in terms of getting that last bit of healing done on the inside, that's, you know, I've got another 2-3 months, you know, waiting time before I start to get
just
wailing.
For people that don't know, this is, you had some cancer issues in your tongue and in your throat, and that's been taken care of, but you're still healing from the radiation treatment.
Yeah, the radiation. Gotcha. Yeah, absolutely. You know, because the I had a golf ball basically in my tongue. It was about
your tongue.
Yeah, in the base of my tongue. Which goes goes right the way back there.
Okay.
So basically, effectively, almost the head of this Shure microphone was growing. Maybe that's what it was.
Maybe you swallowed a microphone.
Maybe
I was
growing a microphone. You know. But I had one. Years. I had one DAC here, and then another one in a lymph node next door, which is 2.5 centimeters. And so they got rid of that with chemo and radiation at the same time, which finished in. Finished in March, and I'm still, the radiation still cooks you for another 3 months. So March, April, May, so then I had the scan, which gave me the all clear, which is great. And then you really start to undo the damage that was done, you know. So crazy stuff that you don't really think about in normal life, like your saliva has been pretty much wiped out. The glands have been pretty much wiped out, but they will recover. And so mine are, you know, like I've got loads more now than I did like 2 months ago. Mucous membranes just quit. They quit. So you're not generating any mucus to lubricate the soft tissues here. So it is like being in the desert 24/7. So you can't really sing in that state.
Right. As a singer, to keep lubricated is the most important thing.
Absolutely. So lubricated as opposed to hydrated. Because you can drink water till you're blue in the face. That's great. But you need to let those cells physically regenerate and start working again. And there's just nothing you can do to hurry up that process. It's going to take as long as it takes. But given, I mean, I've been really good with the recovery so far. The last... I had a checkup last week, you know, and I have a checkup every month. And they have a look with the scope, and the doctor, he goes, yeah, he said, that's looking really, really good. He said, it's healing up fantastically. He said, there's a few little bits of swelling there that's just starting to, you know, disappear now. And so even now, you know, you're 3-4 months out, there's still residual swelling in there that will take time and time and time to go away. Having said that, I'm chatting away and yelling, and the great news is that the larynx is completely unaffected. Was never affected, was never part of it, was never zapped by the radiation. So that's great. So all the notes are still there.
So you've practiced and done a few.
I've been in the kitchen, had a good yell, you know. And I said, can I do Troop Up? Yeah. Can we do the opening song? Yeah, let's do the opening song, you know, for the new song and new album and everything. And you know, you do notice there's a few bits that go, oh, that's a bit weird and it sounds a bit strange and a bit scratchy. But there's all the power is there. And because that, again, that's nothing to do with it. And all the high notes are there. It's just some of the ones in between. And I think it's a question. I think it's almost a question of it's like being an athlete. And you've had, let's say you're a sprinter or something else like that. And you've had some real major tendon damage. And they fix it all up, and you can walk around, and you can, you know, do stuff. And people say, oh, so you look fine. You look great. Yeah. So you're going to run the 100 meters. They went, it's going to take a little while.
Yeah.
And we got to really work up to that, you know, because it's not quite that simple. You know, even though I can take the stairs two at a time and I can run for a bus. It's a little bit different when you're trying to do a 9.5 second 100 meter dash.
Yes, or a 2 hour Iron Maiden show singing.
Exactly.
Is there a song in the set that you have to play like a trooper? That's, you see it and you go, it's not hard to sing, but it's a little bit of a challenge.
Oh, there usually is one in every show, and actually, it's not so much the song; it's where it is located
in the set.
So. You know, dependent upon where it's located, you know, Run to the Hills can be, you know, a pain in the neck. And the same thing with, you know, Hallowed sometimes. Aces High was always, like on the last tour, it was the first encore. So no pressure there then. You come back and have a big thing, fanfare, you know, flares, everything else. And you've got to hit all these notes. And of course, you've already been going for an hour and 40 minutes or something. So Aces High was always the take a big deep breath and like, okay, relax, come on. You know?
How was it when you opened with that song back in the day? That was the whole Power Slave opening song.
Yeah, well, sometimes opening with a song like that, you know, you get it out of the way early.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and also psychologically it's strange because the audience often, they're not listening that hard because they're a bit overwhelmed by everything.
They're so excited to see you. Yeah.
By the time you've screwed it up, they've missed it, you know.
You're on to the next one already, yeah. you guys are famous for doing these long marathon worldwide tours. You got one coming up and still playing new countries. I just read something, I think it's, I don't know, El Salvador or someplace.
Yeah, El Salvador, yeah.
That's amazing to me that there's still places you haven't played.
No, there's plenty. There's loads, actually. There's loads. I mean, the band have played in South Africa before, but I haven't. So, I mean, there's loads of places I've never done Cape Town and Joburg before. For example, China. None of us have been to China before. So that's good. I'm really, really looking forward to going to China.
It's interesting. You'll appreciate it. I was there a few years ago to do a show and in Shanghai, and the architecture. Mm-hmm. You seem like the type of guy that would be impressed by the amazing architecture.
Right.
It seems like each building, like the guy whoever made it, is like, okay, I'm going to outdo this building. I'm going to outdo this building. It's a beautiful city.
Yeah.
It's something you can just actually look and see, like, this is great. You know. Yeah. And that's one of the things that's cool about going around the world, the different cultures and the different things that you see. And I remember the Maiden Behind the Iron Curtain when you guys went to Russia or Poland.
That's it.
First time back, like in 84 or whatever it was.
That's the one.
It's still an amazing documentation of how things were back in those
days. Yeah, no, it was a great documentary, that.
Yeah, it really was.
It really was.
Yeah. You know, I remember watching it as a kid. When you're a kid, you watch it over and over and over. Yeah. You probably quote the whole damn thing. Iron Maiden at the Polish wedding.
Yeah, no, that's it. No, those are great moments in time, you know. It's just little fossilized, cracking moments, classic stuff.
Yeah, that's great. When you think about, like, all the places you've been, what countries stand out for you as having interesting experiences?
Well, Brazil and Chile, I think, you know. But funnily enough, Uruguay. Yeah, I went to Uruguay, and that was an interesting experience because we played. I love railways and things and trains and stuff, and the gig was a train station. And what they'd done was they obviously had two or three different, like, main stations in Uruguay, and they'd one day just and this had like 16 tracks, and it was reminiscent of an English train station from the 1950s, terminus, you know. There was 16 tracks, all with the buffers, and they'd set up the stage over the tracks, so you were facing out, looking down the train shed, looking down the line. But there were no trains. Well, there were, but they were sitting there. They were kind of mothballed, and they were old steam engines. And further up the line, like about 2 miles up the line, then they the trains were actually operating from another station. But they just kind of cut this train station off and said, shut now, that's it. And it's kind of fossilized it, you know. And it was weird. It was like walking through a film set, you know, of 1950s. And when you did the show, the track numbers were just about, you know, 3 or 4 feet above your head. And the audience was standing on the tracks. And it was like, okay, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of weird, but cool. And then I was wandering around during the daytime, you know, and having to poke around these old steam engines and things, you know, and a lot of them were German from the Second World War. We did a lot of trade with Uruguay, and there was a famous ship sunk in the River Plate, Graf Spee, I think it was, which is a German battleship, which was cornered there, and the skipper, rather than go out and basically kind of commit suicide with his ship, decided to scuttle the ship. So he told all the sailors to go offshore, and he sank the ship in the middle of the River Plate.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. It was a big standoff. And, of course, Uruguay was neutral. So all these 2,000, however many there were, German sailors went ashore and stayed there for the rest of the war and had a great time.
Mm.
You know, lots of little German Uruguayan little babies. And so we're doing this gig there, and I'm suddenly sat there and realizing that the railway that I'm looking at, no wonder it looks English, because it was all built by Welshmen who were employed. And there's this big plaque on the wall saying, you know, all these people who built it, and they're all from Cardiff and Swansea or what have you. And outside was a tea shop. So I go into the tea shop, and I swear to God, this was a Bavarian tea shop in the middle of Uruguay. And on the wall was pictures, big black and whites, of the sailors from Graf Spee and the Graf Zeppelin that used to stop in Uruguay on the way over.
Right.
There's these pictures of airships and Zeppelins and things like that. I'm thinking, what an incredible experience. This is surreal. you know, what just a to bad see this, place yeah. to see this, all these little things fossilized, frozen in time, you know. So that was one of my favorite South American moments. And the other one was, you know, Brazil, you know, Rock in Rio, obviously big rock and roll moment. But the other one was the capital of Brazil, Brasilia, which looks like that there's all this, I forget the name of the architect, but really famous architect. And he put in all these futuristic buildings in the middle of Brasilia. And you will imagine that you're actually on the set of Star Trek. Just so cool. So South America, it's a real, real interesting place.
It's amazing you get a chance to go around the world and see all these things. And also the worldwide fan base of Iron Maiden is incredible. We talked earlier about how the band is bigger now than ever. What is it about Iron Maiden that appeals to so many people everywhere in the world?
Well, first, I think one of the things is that we are properly unique. The other one is that we are not just unique, but also I think we're pretty authentic. You know, we haven't sold out or done crass commercial things, and you know, and anything we have done, like, you know, the beer trooper and things like that, we've done with some style, and we've done it well, you know, and we've done stuff that's appropriate to our, you know, identity, you know, not just done stuff just to be crass and, you know, make loads of money and be a schmuck, you know.
It's real, like you said, it's unique and it's real. A few final questions. It's funny, in about 2008, I used to have really long hair. I cut it. And people were so outraged. You got to grow your hair back. How can you be Chris Jericho without long hair? And I was always thinking, well, Bruce Dickinson cut his hair. Did you get the same reaction when you first cut it from the rockers? Like, how can you be Bruce Dickinson?
They get over it. you know, and actually... what I did discover that the store detectives didn't follow me around in supermarkets anymore.
You didn't get searched going through security at the airport either, right? Because you had the classic long hair of the 80s, super long bangs.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I remember trying to leave Canada once. Nico had got blood poisoning in his arm from blisters that had gone, you know, goopy, you know, playing drums. And we had to take a whole week off. I mean, Montreal in winter. And we thought, Florida sounds nice. So we were going to hightail it out. And I went through and I thought, I'd go through security and everything, like, you know, really early. And this is in the early 80s somewhere. And I've got this big, like, fur. I've got this, like, fur coat. I've got long hair. I'm, like, 26 years old or something, you know. And, I've got a business class ticket and a huge carry-on bag. And this guy just takes everything apart, just takes the whole thing apart. And I'm sitting there going, I don't take drugs, so I've got nothing to hide. So bang, you know, and he's got talcum powder and he's sniffing it. I'm thinking, I'm going to give you a headache, you know. I mean, you know, and he goes, and finally, right at the bottom of the bag, this kid, some kid had given me like a little studded wristband. And I said, thanks very much. But in the bag, forgotten about it. He pulled it out, and it's really small, and it's got completely flattened studs. They're not spiky in any way, shape, or form. They're flattened.
Yeah, the flat studs. Yeah.
And he says, watch this. I said, studded wristband. He goes, this is an offensive weapon. I went, you are kidding me, aren't you? Yeah. I said, no, you're not kidding, are you? I said, okay. I said, well, I can't argue with you. I said, because if you say it is, then... it must be so. Didn't even know I had it in my bag, to be honest with you. I said, throw it away. I don't mind. He said, I can't do that, sir. It's a very serious offense. I went, okay. All right, then.
Here's how it's going to be.
Okay. So now what happens? I can't possibly tell you. It's outside my jurisdiction. Right. Okay. So somebody doesn't like my face today. So anyway, up comes the Mountie. Proper, you know,
red coat, hat,
Dudley do right, the whole thing, you know. And I'm like, okay. So I said, pleased to see you, lad. So, you know, it appears that the blah blah blah. And he goes up, So he's inspecting it, like, yeah. I see the studs, yeah. See the problem, yeah. So they take me away. So I sit down. They takes me into a little side room, you know, and I fill out a prisoner's arraignment form. You know,
wow.
And so I'm sitting there and I'm looking at the thing. I think my flight goes in about half an hour. okay. I said, okay. I said, so, right. So you've got the wristband, and you probably know that, you know, you can buy these things on Yonge Street with like 6-inch spikes coming out of them, right, and everything else, you know. So I said, but regardless of that, he said, empty your pockets. I went, okay, bang. And I'd just gotten my per diems.
Uh-huh.
Right? So I had two $100 bills. And he goes, where'd you get these? I said, I got them from my tour manager who gives them to me every week as my per diems. And he goes, right. And he phones the serial numbers through of the bills. And they come back and he goes, guess that's okay then. You know, I went, okay. I said, so here I am. I filled out your form. You got the wristband. Now what happens? He goes, this is a matter for the local police. He said, so it's outside my jurisdiction. I went, I'm getting the picture now. Mm-hmm. I said, do you ever gamble? And he said, I don't know what you mean, sir. I said, are you a betting man? I said, because I'm willing to bet that at 1 minute past 1:30, when my flight has gone, the local police will walk in through that door. And at 1 minute past then, the local police walked in, dressed slightly more drab. They were wearing what, you know, looked like a couple of grow bags, you know, and stuff. Didn't have the red tunic and the hat and everything. Yeah. And they came in, and they were very sweet. And they too inspected the wristband, uh-huh, and looked at it and felt, and they discussed the flattened nature of the studs and how it didn't look like you could do much harm with that. And, and they said, well, maybe we should just confiscate it. and I said, thanks very much. I said, and he said, yep, you're free to go. I went, thank you very much. May I have another? So I left, and I thought, the next flight is in 4 hours, and I'm just sat there, me and a water cooler, for 4 hours, all because I decided to go through security early. And this is a long time ago, you know.
Yeah.
And I think, and I'm trying to leave Canada.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
I mean, I'm trying to leave.
Stay,
you know? I would have thought, a ne'er-do-well like me, you'd be wanting to get rid of me, you know. So I make it down. But strangely enough, years later, I get pulled over by the, not the TSA, but US Customs or whatever it was. And they pull me over. This guy's looking really serious, and he pulls me over. And I had my fencing kit with me. And I was coming into America, and my fencing bag. And I was in the middle of writing a novel, Lord Iffy Boat Race, at the time. And I had the part of the manuscript in the bag, and then I had some other stuff, and I was working, doing some solo stuff, I think, with Roy or whatever it was. So I turn up, and they put me, you know, why are you here? I said, no, I'm just coming here to go and work on a record in LA. Wait, what's this? This is my fencing kit. What? Fencing kit? What do you mean? And they look, and they think, huh? What's this? I said, it's a novel I'm writing. What? You know, and after a while, they said, they went, okay, why have we stopped you? I said, I got no idea why you've stopped me. I said, can you tell me? He goes, well, he said, you're obviously not a criminal. You're obviously not a drug smuggler. I said, so I don't know why we stopped you. I said, well, can you find out? He goes, yeah, hang on a minute. So he gets the supervisor in, and the supervisor comes in and goes, oh, let's have a look. He says, da, 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 da. He said, did you have a problem years ago in Montreal with a studded wristband?
Last question. We're in Winnipeg, 1988. We hear Bruce Dickinson on the radio, Seventh Son Tour, and we're like, put two and two together. If he's on the radio, we can go to the radio station and we'll probably see him.
Yeah.
My cousin and I, we go, you come out, we're standing there like two idiots, don't know what to say, and you're like, would you like a picture? Yes, sir, Mr. Dickinson, take a picture. My cousin was in a high school band.
Right.
His band was called Cletus.
And he goes, I remember them.
He goes, Bruce, would you like a t-shirt from a Saskatchewan rock band for Cletus? And you said yes. You took the t-shirt. What did you do with the Cletus t-shirt?
I think I actually wore it somewhere. I did wear it. You know,
he is going to flip out.
I remember that band.
You do really remember this?
I remember that. It wasn't in Winnipeg in winter, was it?
It was Winnipeg Seventh Son Tour.
It probably a bit before. Because I remember we did once play Winnipeg in the depths of winter. And
yeah,
it was
that
like
would be
minus
84, probably Power Slave Tour.
Oh,
yeah.
God forsaken. I went out and I went for a walk around the square in front of the hotel. This is the most stupid thing I think I'd ever done for, you know, donkey's years. I came back, my eyeball eyeballs were like frozen, and I like everything was frozen.
Your nose hair is hard.
Oh man, I thought I'm not going to make it back. I thought, you know, Captain Scott's got nothing on this. You know,
Stranger in a Strange Land. You're going to find your buried corpse. What's your favorite song to sing live?
Well, it varies from tour to tour, but obviously, I mean, last tour, I just get a big, I always get a big kick out of singing Seventh Son. I love that tune. You get really wrap your gills around it and, you know, let rip, you know.
New record, Book of Souls, Bruce Dickinson. It's great to talk to you, man. My cousin's going to flip on the Cletus t-shirt.
Yeah.
Thanks to Bruce Dickinson. The new Iron Maiden album, The Book of Souls, is out now. Came out today, as a matter of fact, and what an honor to talk to Bruce on the day of the album's release. My inner fanboy is freaking out. I can't believe he remembered Cletus. Like, literally, Chad gave him the Cletus shirt, and we were laughing. The next day, Nico was probably polishing his cymbals with it or something along those lines. But Bruce remembered Cletus, and if he didn't remember, he sure did fake it well. So thanks to Bruce. I'm sure nobody else asked him that question during this crazy press junket that he had. He did so many interviews, but he was still so cool. I love the story about him with long hair. That's how it used to be. All of us that had long hair, you guys know what I'm talking about. We were always judged when we had long hair for being drug dealers. It must be a drug dealer. He's got long hair. But cool to have Bruce on. And like I said, the Book of Souls, you need to go pick it up. And I know where you can get it. Amazon. You know what you do if you want to buy it on Amazon. Use the Talk is Jericho links. Go to podcastone.com. Click on the Support Our Show sponsors banner at the top of the page. Hit the Talk is Jericho button. You got links in the USA, the UK, the Canada. Every time you use them links, Amazon kicks back a little money to help us pay the production costs. Help me pay transportation costs to fly up to New York to talk to Bruce Dickinson live just so you can hear it. Go on to the Amazon links. Easiest way to support the show. Won't cost you anything extra. No hidden challenges, I promise. Go help me out with that today. And go get the new Iron Maiden album, The Book of Souls, on Amazon now. It is a cracking album. It's a great, great record. I'm super excited for all of you to hear it. And we'll talk about it more next week. And guess what else is going on next week? The Y2J WWE Fall Tour happens. Yeah, I got four countries in the next 2 months. Edmonton on the 11th. Calgary. There's Toronto, Syracuse, Rochester, Trenton. Madison Square Garden, Y2J 25th anniversary, Jericho versus Owens. A lot of you people wanted to see that. Now you get a chance to see it in Madison Square Garden, the most famous arena in the world, or live on the WWE Network. That is on October 3rd. You are going to love it. All right, then I go to Saudi Arabia. Then I'm hitting Mexico. Then October 30th, Fozzy is getting ready to rock out with the Kiss Navy on the Kiss Cruise. After that, we're taking the Cinderblock Party Tour back to the UK and Europe with Nonpoint and Sumo Psycho in tow. The dates start November 13th in Rotterdam, Vienna, Hamburg, Berlin, Cologne. November 20th in France, then Luxembourg, Reading, London, Manchester, Southampton, Birmingham. So many great shows coming up. Go to FozzyRock.com for all the cities, all the venues, all the ticket information. I want to see you there. Come rock with us. Thanks again to all of you. Thanks again to Bruce. Thanks again to my great sponsors, Nature Box. Use the promo code Jericho to get some free snackolas. DraftKings, you might use my promo code Jericho to play for free. And SeatGeek, use my promo code ChrisJ to get a $20 rebate with your first purchase. Thank you so much for rocking with me. Thank you so much for doing what you do. Stay hard. Stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs. And next Wednesday, I got another great rock and roll Hall of Famer, the return of Paul Stanley, here on Talk is Jericho to discuss the 40th anniversary of Kiss Alive. That's right, September 9th, 1975, Kiss Alive was released. It might have been September 10th, somewhere in that area. And on the exact 40-year anniversary of that monumental, crazy live record, Paul Stanley will be here to talk all about that. Who gets you the best guests? Yeah, I do. Yeah, boy, yeah, boy, yeah, boy. Paul Stanley on Wednesday. We'll see you then.
I'll give it all I got. You give it all you got. Woo! Pretty good. Check this out.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.